Hi, besties, and welcome to a brand new Almost Adulting, the largest self-love podcast and movement, your number one destination for personal growth and mental health. I am your big sister, your best friend, and your host, Violetta. And today, I'm welcoming you to part two with Sarah Baldwin. You guys love the episode that we had 2 weeks ago with her, which was all about regulating your nervous system. What even is a nervous system? Why is it normally dysregulated, which has to do a lot with our anxieties and all that. Like, I think I'm always at a nervous state of mind. So it's cool to know that I also have a nervous system. My system's always nervous, am I right? Anyway, today we're going to dive more into the nervous system, but we are full on going to dive into attachment styles, which I know some of you guys love, which is all about secure attachment style, avoidant attachment style, anxious attachment style, fearful. Can an anxious and avoidant date? What does that even mean? If they can date, how do we make it work? And so on. You guys are going to love today's episode. So make sure to download it so you can always find it and listen to it over and over and over again on how to make those type of relationships with different attachment styles work. Make sure to follow Sarah after you finish listening to my episode. And of course, make sure to write me a 5-star review if you enjoy today's episode. It helps my podcast. I'm always really thankful because I read all of them. Okay? Love you, besties. Enjoy.
You cannot resolve an argument when two people are dysregulated. So don't try. Like, if anyone listening, if you're in a relationship and you're both in a fight, if you're fighting, you're both dysregulated, you are like have swords out at each other and there's no way to resolve it. You have to pause and say, okay, we're both dysregulated. This is a waste of our time right now. I care about you. I love you. We have to go regulate and then come back together.
So how does your nervous system affect your relationships?
So our nervous system is actually the vehicle responsible for how we experience all of our relationships, meaning it's informing how I connect to you or anybody else in my life. And a lot of people have read the book, like the book Attached, or listened to things on attachment. And what you might notice is you gather the information and you're like, oh, this makes sense. I'm an anxiously attached person or an avoidantly attached person. And you cognitively get it. Like, oh, I get that's what I do. But that doesn't actually change what's happening in the relationship. And that's because the way you attach has nothing to do with your mind. It has everything to do with your nervous system, which, as I've said, lives in our bodies.
Right.
So because earlier I mentioned our nervous system actually creates our behaviors. So it creates the behaviors for how we show up in our relationship. So if someone has, let's say, an anxious attachment style, that means, which is all about, I need to feel, in order for me to feel safe, I need you close to me. Then my nervous system is going to use my sympathetic nervous system in order to be in relationship, because that's all about the doing, right? So mm-hmm. I need to resource my sympathetic nervous system. If I'm an avoidant person, my nervous system doesn't feel safe with other people. So I'm kind of like an island. I feel safer alone. So my nervous system is going to resource that dorsal state of shutdown or disconnection in order for me to feel safe in relationships. So, and if I'm disorganized, which is I want people close, but when they're close, I push them away, mm-hmm. I'm going to resource freeze or use freeze in my nervous system.
Let's start with anxious. How does anxious attachment style develop? And what factors contribute to someone having one type over the other?
Our attachment, the blueprint for that, is laid in our earliest childhood experiences. Meaning what happens in your earliest childhood experiences literally lays the foundation for how we relate to people for the rest of our lives. So when babies are born, when we're born, we don't have the ability to self-regulate. So earlier I was talking about how we regulate our nervous systems, meaning we do these neural exercises and we regulate and so on and so forth. When you're a baby, you can't do that.
Right.
You don't have the ability. So that means that we need the adults around us. We need their nervous system to be regulated in order to regulate ours. This is the concept of co-regulation, meaning my nervous system can affect your nervous system. So many of us had parents who did their best, but they had a lot of trauma and they didn't do their work and they weren't regulated all the time. So let's say that I had a mother, for example, who was anxious all the time and she didn't feel safe in her own body. Then when I was born, she couldn't regulate me, meaning because she wasn't regulated. And so the only time that I experienced regulation, even though she was around all the time, let's say, was when she was actually regulated. And she may have even sent me the message that because she didn't feel safe on her own, that I wasn't safe on my own. So what my nervous system learns as a child is I am only safe when I'm like this with her. And I am only safe when she's regulated. So I need to do whatever I can do to make her be regulated, which might be I please her, I try to make her happy, because when she feels good, I feel good.
Got it. And that's how an anxious attachment style begins to develop.
That's right.
So then how does an avoidant attachment style begin to develop?
So an avoidant attachment style also develops, of course, when we're born. Again, we don't have the ability to self-regulate. So if I had caregivers who were neglectful or dangerous and abusive, my nervous system says, wow, I'm in trouble because they're not here. And they might have been neglectful because they were working three jobs. And they might not have been a terrible person, or maybe they were. But my nervous system says, there's no one to help me. What am I going to do? And if they are around, they're dangerous. So our system kind of like protects us by bringing us to this island by ourselves where we disconnect from our needs, because it would be incredibly painful to be perpetually in a place of having needs and them not be met. So we disconnect from having needs. We disconnect from our feelings because we don't want to be in a perpetual place of not having our feeling all of that. And we learn how to go it alone in life, which is what I did. I was severely neglected and I just learned how to do that. And then what that looks like in adult life is there's a deep longing for connection. Like I felt this, like I wanted connection so bad, but I didn't know how to do it. It felt overwhelming when people came close. I didn't know how to ask for help because no one ever helped me. So if a friend was like, you're moving and you're not asking, like, and I, or you're having surgery and you're driving yourself to the hospital, I'm like, well, I don't know. It's fine. Because that blueprint was laid in childhood.
I can definitely relate more to the avoidant attachment style 100%. Mm-hmm. So what should you do if you have avoidant attachment style like both of us?
So the beautiful thing is that through healing, we can actually change this. We can create an internal secure attachment, meaning like I can actually, because remember, we have that internal database with past information. I can fill it with new information that shows my nervous system that it is safe to connect. It is safe to connect with others. Ideally, what we want is that we have the equal ability to self-regulate, so to do things alone that make me feel safe, but also that I can equally be good at leaning on others to regulate. And if you're avoidant, you're really good at self-regulating, like you know how to go it alone, but not so good at leaning on others and connecting deeply with others. So what we want, a few things that we want to work on. Number one is creating those disconfirming experiences through tolerable steps towards regulation. Something that I invite in for people is like, okay, this week, if I'm, say you're avoidant, let's see if I can 5 times this week step off the island just a little bit, knowing that I can come back to the island. So island meaning that's the place of refuge where I feel most comfortable. So we can't just like talk about this and talk therapy and think it's going to change. It won't change because it has to be actionable and it has to be somatic in our bodies. That could literally look like some simple examples when for someone who's avoidant, they're probably really good at listening and not so good at taking up space simply because it's just, I used to think to myself when people would say, how was your day? I'd be like, why do I need to tell you? I already know how my day was. What benefit am I going to get from telling you how my day was?
That's literally me. Yeah.
Right. It's like, that just feels exhausting. Why am I going to do that? So instead, what we want to do is like, can I actually lean into that? And can I let myself, even though it's uncomfortable, even though I don't want to do this, can I actually lean into it and see if I can feel even 2% of what it's like for someone to see me and mirror me? I'm not going to experience 100% of that. But even if they say like, wow, that sounds like it was hard, or like, that's amazing, you did that thing. Mm-hmm. And I like can feel 2%. Excellent. I've just stepped off my island and showed my nervous system it is safe to connect with others. It is safe to lean on others. We want to start giving ourselves those experiences. Otherwise, we can't come out of this thing that we're stuck in. The other thing that's really important, and this could be a whole nother episode, but doing somatic parts work. So, you know, we're talking about how all this has to do with our childhood. Well, inside of us, we all have many internal family systems as a model for parts work, but we all have like an inner child. That might be something, a phrase people understand, or past versions of us. So the way that it works is when we're triggered, let's say, in an avoidant attachment situation, or that's just showing up, it's kind of like when the threat detector is reminded of our childhood, it's sort of like adult me flies out the window and it's like 10-year-old me is present. It's not adult me anymore. And we all know that feeling, you know, when you do something and later you're like, why the fuck did I say that? Or why did I do that? Well, it wasn't actually adult me. It was this little part of me. And so what we want to start also doing is identifying and getting to know our young parts. What do they feel like when they're in our body? They feel super different when you feel like powerful, connected, capable, able. So what do they feel like? And then we have to do a process of what I call internal co-regulation. So I know what that young part feels like. And if I can get my adult self there in present at the same time, I can comfort the young part of me the way that my parents couldn't. So a simple way to do this, I mean, this is a whole other thing, but a simple way to do this is when we're activated in these attachment styles, they're really showing up. It's noticing like, who is this in my body? How old do I feel? Do I feel like me when I'm empowered in my work? Let's say, because I feel like adult me when I'm working. Does it feel like that? If the answer is no, it's not adult me. And I want to check in like, okay, who is this? When's the first time I remember feeling this? That will clue you into however old that part is. And then what we want to do is I want like a simple tool is imagining a moment where you felt really capable and able, like you felt like adult you, and bring that to life. Like one moment where I was like, yep, in that experience, I was on it. I was capable. I was able. And kind of like imagining that, bringing it present. What that does is it gets adult me present in my body at the same time that a young part of me is present. And then what we want to do is soothe that young part. So I might say, okay, to this 10-year-old, I'm going to give you a hug. I'm going to take you on a walk. I'm going to let you know that I'm here and you aren't alone anymore. And again, this is nuanced and complex, but when we do this, we actually imprint new childhood experiences into our psyche, which is super cool. And that actually creates a new childhood. Like literally our system imprints that and thinks that a new experience happened. So when we do both of these things I just named, it actually changes our attachment and how we show up in our relationships.
I like that. I like hearing that. So then what should one do if you have anxious attachment style?
So if you have an anxious attachment style, your system is saying, I feel really safe when I'm with people. I do not feel safe when I'm not with people. So if we have an anxious attachment style, we have the opposite problem where we feel super comfortable with other people. We all want to be with people all the time, but we don't feel comfortable alone. Look at your face. You're like, that's not me. Yeah, that's too much. So if that's us, we have to work on self-regulation. So simple things that we want to do is I really want those people to see if can I tolerate time alone? And can I do things to regulate my, not just time alone where I'm like numbing myself, but can I go on a hike by myself this weekend? And the impulse is I want to go with people, but can I do it alone? And can I see if I can regulate and be present to that experience? And maybe 2% of that feels good. Great. You're building your capacity for self-regulation. That's what we need to work on. Just as an avoidant person needs to build their capacity for closeness and connection. So anything that you can do that, you know, is joyful and makes you feel good that you can try doing solo intentionally is going to support to shift us out of that place of not feeling comfortable by ourselves. It feels like danger. We also want to practice self-regulating tools, like the tools that I gave everybody. Want to practice those consistently. That shows your nervous system that you are safe.
Got it.
And then the same thing that I named, and I won't repeat it, but the same thing about our parts, because an anxious attached person has a young part, many young parts, but let's say there's a 4-year-old that's like, I'm going to die. I'm going to die. I'm going to die if I don't have connection. I'm going to die if I don't have connection. I need you. Ah. I like doing it to see your response because you're like, don't do that to me. And how can we make that little part feel safe with us? Because most people in relationships are choosing partners and friends from survival instead of choice.
Is that why in some ways it seems that avoidant attachment style people tend to attract anxious attachment style people, whether it's in platonic relationships or romantic relationships? It's usually until, of course, people get more regulated and people are more insecure attachment styles. It seems that that's normally what we tend to attract, like the opposite of us.
Yeah, it's the most common combination, not always, but it's the most common combination. And part of that is because how the threat detector works. Remember, we have this threat detector in our brainstem and it says, what does this remind me of? And so our systems like what they know. This is why if I date somebody for two dates and I'm like, oh my God, I feel like I've known you my whole life.
Yeah.
The reason is because the threat detector looks to the database and says, oh, you remind me of my neglectful parent or my overbearing parent. And that's all I know that love is. So I love you.
Right. So we're just repeating a pattern over and over again. Yes. So even though as an avoidant attachment style person, I feel suffocated in the beginning before I do the work by an anxious attachment style person, I will still be drawn to them because it feels familiar and I will hate it.
Yeah.
And I won't understand why I keep repeating the same pattern over and over again and vice versa, but it's because it's the only thing that I know.
That's exactly right. And a metaphor that I use to explain this pretty simply is like this combination is imagine that like the avoidant person is the has an island in the South Pacific by themselves. They're like, this is my island. Please don't come to my island. And so we're together in a relationship, two people, and we get into an argument or something, or there's closeness happening. And all of a sudden the avoidant person is like reflexively, because it's all our nervous system, brings us to our island. Well, the anxious person gets in a fucking speedboat and they're like, I'm coming to your island right now. And they drive all the way to your island. And then they like have a loudspeaker and they're like, get off your island, please get off your island. And then I'm on the island and I'm hiding behind a tree. And I'm like, holy shit, how did they find me? And I'm digging a hole to try to get further away from them. And then they're like throwing like things onto the island to try to get on the island. And the more that they get close, the more I pull away. The more I pull away, the more they get close. So this is actually an opportunity for both of us to heal our childhoods in this dynamic. Mm-hmm. And the work is, my job, if I'm the person on the island, the avoidant person, is can I build a dock and can I come onto the dock? I'm not jumping in your boat, but can I tolerate coming back into connection? For the anxiously attached person, your job is to slow the speedboat down. Can I regulate instead of needing to grasp on? Because I feel like I'm gonna die if I don't have connection. And the avoidant person says, I'm gonna die if you suffocate me. So, and by the way, this is what happens when ruptures or disconnections occur in the relationship. Like we get in a fight. I reflexively, my nervous system takes me to the island, their nervous system takes them on the speedboat. So if that happens, if I'm in a fight, here's what I want each person to do. If I'm avoidant, I don't wanna say like, I can't go to the island. Go to the island. Your nervous system is going to take you there. Mm-hmm. But your job is to tell the person when you're coming back from the island to say, I'm dysregulated. I have to go to my island or need some time. And I will let you know when I'm ready. Can we talk in an hour? Can we talk tomorrow? That's the job of the avoidant person. Instead of just like, I can't talk about this. No, you haven't leaned in. You need to lean in. So your leaning in is saying when you're going to come back in a connection. That also signals to the anxiously attached person, you're not abandoning, you're not leaving. And their job is to tolerate the space and not call you seven times or text you a million times. And instead use self-regulation or regulate with other people while you're taking space.
Right. So that means when the avoidant attachment person says, can we talk in an hour so I can clear my mind? So in a way, letting them know, like, I'm not going anywhere. Just give me some space. It means the other person needs to understand the boundaries versus saying that thing that a lot of times a lot of us hear if we don't communicate in a miscommunication the same way, which is, no, we talk now. You always do this. Let's talk now. I want to talk about it now. Because in that regard is they're only listening to their own nervous system and childhood trauma, and they're not giving grace to the other person who's trying to come in the middle. They're just jumping into the boat. They're like, no, jump into my boat now or never speak to me again.
That's
so
right.
In that way, then since the avoidant person, instead of shutting down and deciding to speak to that person whenever they feel like it, because they said, how about in an hour, then the other person needs to also come in the middle and say, okay, fair. I understand. Right. Can I just tell you how much my hair has transformed in the last 6 months? A while back before that, I was having hair shedding, hair thinning issues because of stress or just life. And I also used to have hair extensions I took out forever ago and I will never put them back in. Once I decided to cut my hair, nourish it, and start from scratch, the best way to start from scratch was to fix my whole routine. And one thing that I added to my routine was Nutrafol supplements. I basically would take them every single morning, and I take 4 in the morning, and I was taking it the last 6 months. I mean, at this point, it's over 6 months. And not only is it natural and 100% drug-free, but I've seen a difference at this point in my lashes, in my eyebrows, and of course, in my hair as well. It is so healthy. It's so beautiful. It's so thick with life, okay? And it's even helped me sleep better at night, which has been really cool. Nutrafol is the number one dermatologist recommended hair growth supplement clinically shown to improve visible thickness and strength. Hair thinning is complicated. The problem is it's actually much bigger than your hair alone, like your skin. Hair is a reflection of your health. And internal factors can impact the way your hair looks, feels, and grows, which is why Nutrafol's whole body approach multi-targets underlining root causes like stress, hormone fluctuations, and nutrient gaps for visible, thicker, stronger hair. Everyone's root causes of hair thinning are different, so a one-size-fits-all approach to hair growth doesn't cut it, okay? Nutrafol has multiple formulas that are tailored to give your hair what it needs to grow throughout different stages, such as postpartum, menopause, as well as different lifestyles, such as plant-based diets. While many supplements rely solely on ingredient studies, Nutrafol clinically tests final formulations to ensure their efficiency. In a clinical study, 86% of women reported improved hair growth after taking Nutrafol's women hair growth supplements for 6 months, me being one of them. All you need to do is take their hair wellness quiz on Nutrafol.com for a personalized hair health plan based on your specific root causes. With Nutrafol, building a hair growth routine is simple, you guys. You purchase it online, no prescription required, it's free shipping, and its automated deliveries ensure that you will never miss a day. And you will see results in 3 to 6 months. So take the first step to visible, thicker, healthier hair. For a limited time, Nutrafol is now offering my listeners $10 off of your first month subscription and free shipping when you go to Nutrafol.com and enter my promo code ADULTING. So why not find out why over 4,500 healthcare professionals and hairstylists recommend Nutrafol for healthier hair? That is Nutrafol.com, spelled Nutrafol.com with my promo code ADULTING. That's Nutrafol.com using promo code ADULTING. Take the first step to visible, thicker, healthier hair today.
And if it's a close person to us, ideally, we want to both be able to say, okay, I'm dysregulated, you're dysregulated. And here's the key, here's like a golden rule. You cannot resolve an argument when two people are dysregulated. So don't try. Like if anyone listening, if you're in a relationship and you're both in a fight, if you're fighting, you're both dysregulated, you are like have swords out at each other and there's no way to resolve it. You have to pause and say, okay, we're both dysregulated. This is a waste of our time right now. I care about you. I love you. We have to go regulate and then come back together. So I, as the avoidant person, I have to go to my island. Can we recheck in an hour? Their job is to tolerate that and say, yes, and I'm going to go regulate myself right now so that I'm not trying to grip, you know, onto you for survival. And when we do this, we're healing our attachment, which means relationships get to be filled with more ease.
What's helped me so far, I would say, just from a recent, what I believe was a conflict, wasn't really much of a conflict, but what helped me, I feel like, as an avoidant attachment person, and maybe can help someone out there listening, or maybe can tell me whether or not I'm doing it properly. But I've noticed when I was experiencing somewhat of a disagreement with a friend who has more of an anxious attachment style, my first reaction when I felt her emotions or she let me know of all her emotions at once, which is something I don't do. I'm not as open about that. It freaked me out. And of course, my brain got defensive and all these thoughts came around where I'm in danger. She's the worst. This is where I feel suffocated. I can't handle those emotions. And it felt like such a mountain out of a little speed bump. But I realized what helped me is when I suddenly gave her some grace where I humanized because I build this mountain in front of me. So right away, it felt so dangerous where I just shut down. I'm like sick of her. I never like, okay, it's not even worth it. But then when I felt that I humanized her and I saw her as this person, I saw her childhood self as a person that like, oh, she's reacting this way because she loves me so much and she's, you know, scared that she's going to lose me or she feels like I'm scolding her or whatever it is. When I kind of humanized her in a way where I saw her again, I was like, okay, I can try to understand her side. And that's when I said, hey, I think we're having a miscommunication. I think we're having different conversations. Let me get back to you in a bit. And that's when a few hours later, I decide to finally come back with a solution that I thought could help us both move forward.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And that's what you did A++++ job. Yeah, that's what we're looking for. And otherwise, relationships are exhausting and scary, and we're projecting onto whomever we're in relationship with our entire childhood. I did that my whole life, and it's terrible. It's exhausting. It makes things really, really hard. When we can see, and everyone might not be able to catch it as quick as you did. That's amazing. You caught it that quick. I just want people to know it doesn't matter when you catch it. Like, even if later in the day you're like, oh, you know what? They were just hurting. That's all. They just felt hurt. And that was triggering their childhood. And then we can communicate that. That helps to heal the relationship too in our past.
What would you say the most common dynamic is between an avoidant attachment style person and an anxious attachment style person?
The most common thing I would say, or dynamic between an anxious attachment person and avoidant attachment person, is the anxious attachment person wanting more from them and in the relationship, and wanting the relationship to progress faster if it's romantic, mm-hmm. and the avoidant person wanting the relationship to progress slower and needing more space, and including like, an avoidantly attached person after work might need decompression time, or like time alone on the weekend. And the anxiously attached person is often going to want higher levels of connection. And so when we can meet in the middle and compromise, we actually can help each other heal in pretty big ways.
How would you say avoidant and anxious attachment styles affect romantic relationships, and what strategies can partners use to navigate through these dynamics?
So in romantic partnerships, it's, as I said, the most common combination is somebody who's avoidant and someone who's anxious. I want to just give this caveat that it's also really important to understand that we're not all one thing. And meaning we have a culmination. We might be a little anxious, very avoidant, and slightly disorganized, which we haven't talked about much yet. So we have a combination usually. And that's because we have multiple caregivers in our childhood. It's not just one caregiver. There's many people around. So let's say, this has happened to me before, if there's two avoidant people together, mm-hmm. and the other person's more avoidant than me, then that's going to activate my anxious attachment parts. So that's just for anyone listening who's like, why in this relationship am I more anxious? In this one, I'm more avoidant. Like, why in my work relationships do I feel more anxiously attached? And then my personal ones, I feel more avoidantly attached. And this is why, because we have that combination in it. So it just depends who
that
we're in the
sense.
Dance.
I like that, because I think in the past when I spoke to some experts, they made it seem like, no, it's just one attachment style all around. And I remember I was really confused, because I said, well, I feel like I have secure attachment styles in certain areas of my life, and then avoid in some areas. And so that's why I categorize myself, oh, I must be disorganized, which is not the case, hearing that now, because it's just people bring out different things in you.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And different people I date might bring out different things in me, depending on who I'm dating. If someone's coming at me pretty strongly, that might trigger of my avoidant self. If somebody is like, I really like them, and they're sort of there, and then they're not there, that might trigger my anxious parts. So it's just really important to understand the inner workings of that.
Yeah. One thing that I really appreciate in your work, and we talked about this before we started recording this episode, was how you kind of move away from the common demonization that I've seen when it comes to avoidant types, where anyone who has an avoidant attachment, oh, it's because they don't care. They're heartless, blah, blah. Well, anxious style people, they have so much love to give, and they're just so loving and blah, blah. And why do you think avoidant attachment style people tend to be so often misunderstood?
I would actually say that I think both are misunderstood, both anxiously attached and avoidant. Here's the negative connotation with anxiously attached people. You're needy and you're too much.
Yeah.
But I would say maybe our culture has got more on the bandwagon of demonizing avoidantly attached people, of you don't care at all and you're selfish or you're a narcissist because you're avoidant.
You don't love the way an anxious attached, because they're just ready to give all their love and they're ready to sacrifice everything. So they must be way more loving than you are. Mm-hmm. There's something wrong with you. You're so cold.
Mm-hmm. And it's right. Those are good examples. Or you disappear, you know, all of those. That's what I used to do. I used to disappear on people for a long time. Like I would get close friends and then I'd be close and they wouldn't hear from me for 5 months. And the whole time I would think, but here's what's important to understand about an anxiously attached person, avoidantly attached person. The whole time I did that for many years, the people that loved me the most, I would disappear on. And I beat myself up over that constantly. I was like, what the fuck is wrong with me? I'm such a shitty person. These people love me. Why can't I let them close? I wasn't like a sociopath feeling like I don't care about your life and I don't care about anything. But it can look like that because the behavior is pulling away. But underneath the behavior of pulling away is this deep desire for connection and the deep desire to be known and to be seen and to be heard. But that feels like the most terrifying thing to an avoidantly attached person. It's because this all comes back to our childhood and our nervous system. So if in my childhood, when I was a little kid and I was reaching up to be picked up by a safe, loving parent, if they weren't there, or they were dangerous. Like, this is a vulnerable, like, position to be in. Like, you're supposed to love me the most.
Yeah.
And if my caregivers and I was severely abused and severely neglected, they didn't do that for me. And so what I learned as a little girl was, this is the most painful thing, or one of the most painful things. And I never want to experience that pain again. And so if this is my nervous system's talking, if not my mind. My nervous system says, well, if my own caregivers couldn't show up for me and love me the way they were supposed to, why should I think that this friend is going to? This is all my nervous system again, not my brain. And so my nervous system says, yeah, I want you to have deep love, but I don't want you to ever feel that pain again. So because of that, I am going to be really tentative about letting that person close because, again, if my own caregiver didn't do this for me, why do I think they can? And so then what my system does is it pushes away the thing I really want the most because it doesn't think that it's safe. Mm-hmm. But it's the thing that we want the most. And that's the misunderstanding of people who are avoidant and the thought that, no, they just don't care. That's not true. They're fucking terrified. That's what's actually happening internally. Now, they might not be connected to the terror, but that's what's really going on. It's a little part that feels terrified of having this kind of closeness and connection. Just as an anxiously attached person is terrified that they're going to die if they're on their own.
Which I guess would be the best example would be something that you said earlier in the episode where you have to train your nervous system by doing little things one by one instead of just going to the same way in an exercise. Instead of lifting 75 pounds or 100 pounds, you start with smaller weights until you're able to get there. So I think it's the same thing with avoidant attachment style or anxious attachment style for an avoidant person. That love that someone else will try to bring, if we're not familiar with it, of course is going to feel overwhelming. That's why it's better to do that in those little steps where it's a little bit attention, a little bit more attention, all that, and like, okay, this feels safe versus here's all my love. Why can't you just accept it? Because you feel, and that's why you feel suffocated because it's just, it's not familiar and you don't know what to do with it.
And you're just going to go further to the island. And so we really need to learn to understand each other. And as someone, you know, I was very avoidant and that's luckily changed in my life, but through this work, not like mystical, wow, it just changed. All this work I'm talking about is what changed it. And a place that I started and that I invite people to start that are avoidant is communicating in person my deep feelings for you or my experience inside is going to be way too much. So starting with literally like for some people that might be through text, I can actually share more vulnerably. I can't do it in person yet, but I can do it through text. Great, then that's the starting point. That's where we want to start. And letting people know who love us that this is what feels safe to me. And then their job is to celebrate that. Like if the goal is that we have people in our lives who see us and understand us and that we see and understand them. And so if I'm avoidant, I need to be taking these tolerable steps. And what I see right now too much in our culture is because we're all so hungry for information. that people gather so much information without taking, which is good, but then we don't take the tangible steps we need to take.
Right. It's like a lot of people go to therapy and like, I have these tendencies, blah, blah. Well, that's it. That's good enough versus actually, okay, but how do we actually fix that? Now that I'm aware that I'm a cheater because I'm insecure.
Yeah.
What do I do to fix that so I won't continue to be a cheater? It's, not me personally.
No, but people. But it's literally like, imagine if I watched workout videos all day long and like theory on working out and I sat on my couch and I ate chips all day and I'm like, this is so good to know. Why is my body not changing? You'd be like, well, Sarah, I don't know. Did you have a lobotomy? Why don't you understand what's happening right now?
Because I'm not doing anything with the information I'm receiving.
Yeah.
I am really curious though about, since you're speaking about you being used to have an avoidant attachment style and feeling abandoned as a child. Do you mind walking me through at what exact point in your life did you feel that, okay, this is not working for me anymore. I need to make a change. What exactly happened to you that you said, I can't do this anymore?
I'll try to say it succinctly, but I think it could be helpful to share my story because a lot of us feel, sorry to swear, but we just feel like we're really fucked up. You know, like, oh, what's wrong with me? And then we see people talking, like maybe people listening see me and like, oh, she's, you know, it's probably not that hard and I'm so fucked up and she's not. So I just want to share this for anybody who might feel that way because that's how I felt. I had an extremely hard time with relationships because I have an extreme trauma history. I was sexually abused inside my home for a long time. I was severely neglected. I grew up in poverty. I was basically non-functional for most of my life. And that meant because there was so much danger, my stepfather sexually abused me, my mother knew and didn't do anything, I had no safety. So the people romantically that I drew in were people who did not love me, and my biological father abandoned me. So because of all that, I drew in people who weren't safe, who didn't love me, who had other significant others that I didn't even know about, because that's how the threat detector works. Actually, from the ages of 14 to like 22, almost every single person I dated, including like even when I was 15, had significant others I found out about later. Wow. And why? Because that's how the threat detector works. So I would attract narcissistic people who it was all about them and I had no needs and I had to be small and I was scared and, you know, and was in this like codependent dynamic with them. And I also have a lot of disorganized attachment. So I want people close and they get close and I push them away and then I want them close and I push them away. And it was like terror all the time. But I felt like I'm going to die though if I don't have some kind of connection. But then wait, I don't want connection. So it was just, it was really hard. And then I got married at 25. I met my ex-husband at 22. And he was the safest person that I had ever met. But he still had all the needs. I had no needs. I was invisible. All the things. But it was... it was like kind of a miracle that I chose someone that was at least, wasn't dangerous. And the thing is, what I want people to know is like, I couldn't have chose a great guy because I didn't have the capacity for it. Meaning like it would have been way too much for my nervous system to have a guy that was like kept showing up and like asked me how I was and like saw me. I'd be like, don't see me. It's too much to see me. So that was within my capacity. And so for people, if you're saying like, why do I keep choosing these people? Well, it's because you haven't built your capacity yet to choose different. And so inside my marriage, I was married for 10 years. I started to heal and I started to do a lot of my work and I started to have needs now because I did the inner child work and I regulated my nervous system. And I was like, wait, I actually want you to see me. I built my capacity for it. I want to be known by you. I want to, you know, have this deeper connection. And he did not do his work. And what happens is, and this happens in relationships as we heal, both people need to be healing. Otherwise, what happens is now I'm coming to the relationship because every relationship has like a, what's called, or I call an unwritten contract. Like we get into the relationship with this thing where it's like, okay, so you're going to overwhelm me. I'm going to get overwhelmed by you and I'm going to not be able to handle that. Or you have needs, I don't have needs. And we're like, cool, this reminds me of childhood. And then we like love each other because we're reminded of our childhood. But then when we heal, it's like I wrote a new contract and I was like, actually, here's my role. I have needs now and I want to take up space now. And I actually want to be able to be mad at you sometimes without you gaslighting me. So what do you think about that? And usually if they're not doing their work, they're like, I don't like this.
Right. That's normally when people tend to grow apart instead of grow together. Exactly. If only one person is doing the work, then that's why for the other person, it feels that you're not who I used to know. This isn't who I married. This isn't who I signed the contract with. This is a completely different person. It's because you outgrew each other.
Yeah.
The new stage of who you are as a person is no longer compatible with the old stage of this person.
That's right.
Only the old stage of you could date this person was compatible. But the new stage of you, that's why I normally tend to say, don't go back to exes.
Yeah. Unless they are doing the work too.
Right.
And the one of my mentors, Harville and Helen Hendricks, they're pretty famous couples therapists. They say a great partnership or marriage has many divorces. What they mean by that is because we should always be growing and rewriting the contract together. We're making it new, making it new. So what happened was I did my work and then that didn't work anymore. And so getting divorced was a real celebration. And now as I'm dating for the first time in 16 years, which is pretty wild, it's a whole different thing. And because I have an internal secure attachment. So the things that are attractive to me now, like someone who is consistent, available, communicates well, loves deeply, meets my needs, is curious about me, wants to know me, is incredibly safe, honors my boundaries, all of those things I'm actually attracted to versus when I was younger, I would have been actually disgusted by that. Like, ew.
Right.
Like gross. So that's what our healing brings.
What is the bravest thing that someone with an avoidant attachment style can do in a relationship?
The bravest thing. So,
yeah.
Okay. I would say the bravest thing that a person who's avoidantly attached in a relationship, the bravest thing they can do is this, and I'll give some examples of what this looks like, but for the young part of them to actually vulnerably reach out and be metaphorically saying, pick me up. And that means taking off the armor that we wear and allowing our most vulnerable parts, the parts that were never seen and never met, to actually not just let the person meet our need, but reach out to them and ask them to. That is maybe the most vulnerable, the most brave thing we can do.
What is the bravest thing that someone with an anxious attachment style can do in a relationship?
I'd say the bravest thing an anxiously attached person can do in a relationship is to, when they have the impulse of feeling like I'm going to die or not be okay in this situation, is to choose themselves.
Mm.
Because what anxiously attached people do is connection is more important than anything. So they will sacrifice their own needs, their own desires to keep the connection. So in many ways, it's saying, I am going to bravely be me, regardless of how that makes you feel, because I am saying I don't need the connection for survival. I know that I'm safe with me, which is a really big risk for someone who's anxiously attached to do.
So can an avoidant attachment style person and someone who has anxiously attachment style make it in a relationship?
Absolutely. This is like a beautiful opportunity for us to both heal our past together because we are both activating for each other the scary stuff from childhood. So if we can actually help each other with those scary things from childhood, we can heal the past and the present through our relationship, which is like so beautiful.
Amazing. Okay. Because I think a lot of people, a lot of times, a lot of podcasts, what they hear is that it's never going to work until you have your secure attachment style and you should do the work before you get in a relationship.
No.
But I like the fact that if two people understand that, okay, we do have different attachment styles, but we both want to do the work on ourselves. I'm not changing for you. I want to change for me.
Yes.
And you do the work, then you're able to then grow together as two people who have different attachment styles.
100%. And so I don't want you to think like that's a death sentence. And the other thing is, one of my mentors, I've been doing my own somatic trauma healing work for 15 years. One of my mentors who's like world renowned said to me at one point, and I do therapy with him, he said, okay, Sarah, it's time to get into a relationship. And I was like, what do you mean? I'm doing all this work. And he's like, well, yeah, but you have to get into a relationship because there's things that you cannot do in the healing container. You have to do it in the relationship.
Mm.
And so I don't want people to think like you have to be a finished, you cannot be a finished project. You have to get into the relationship. And our goal is that we choose a healthier person. And then from that place, we are continuing to do our work together. So I don't want people to think like, okay, I can't date until I finish all of this work or any of that. It's not that at all. The relationship itself is where a lot of the healing happens.
Right. I like that. I think I used to believe also that you had to heal on your own first before, because, you know, you have to be your best self before you can meet the best version of what you're looking for. But the truth is you tend to learn more about yourself when you are with a partner, because normally when we start to date, it's constantly a mirror being held right in front of us, because we tend to date either our past trauma, or we tend to date a reflection of ourselves, a reflection of the things we hate about ourselves the most. And the closer we get with the partner, the more vulnerable we are, the closer the mirror gets, the bigger it gets in front of us, so we can't avoid it anymore. And I think that's normally where the work comes in, where you have to do what I normally call shadow work. And mm-hmm. I've discussed it before, to what you're also calling the bigger picture, which is the regulation of your nervous system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and trauma work. Yep. Yeah, exactly. And what I'd want to invite in for people is, when we're dating, what we want to just do is listen to our nervous systems. So if I'm feeling around somebody, I'm feeling like pretty big dysregulation with them, or panic, or high cues of danger, that might be a, but I'm really attracted to them, that might be a clue that my nervous system is saying, this is reminding me of something dangerous in the past. Doesn't mean they're exact replica, but it might mean I can't fully trust them, or they're not going to listen to my boundaries, or whatever. And we want to listen to that instead of being seduced into that. Like, it almost feels like a hypnotic drug when we're right in that experience.
Okay, I like that. I want to kind of focus on that. That would be my next question. I'm curious, how can you tell the difference between when you are getting to know someone in a potential relationship, platonic or romantic, and you get that feeling where, oh, I feel danger? How can you tell the difference between, oh, but it's that discomfort that actually wants me to take a leap because I have to put myself out there, or I feel danger because this is actually dangerous. This is, it's my intuition, whatever it is, my regulation system telling me, like, hey, red flag, red alert, yeah, run. Like, how are you able to decipher between those two things? Yeah.
A couple of ways. So first, I just want to name that fear and excitement have the same somatic sensory response in our body. The sensation is actually very similar and hard to tell the difference between the two. So just want to name that. This is confusing for a lot of people. Two things we want to focus on. Number one, we want to ask ourselves, do I feel like my little self around this person, small, scared, or do I feel like adult me nervous? Okay. So like, you know, I haven't dated in a long time. So adult me that's nervous, of course, is showing up. A lot of people feel nervous about dating. So that's a really different thing than me feeling like small, insignificant, scared, little. Does that make sense?
Got what I'm it. Saying? So adult me nervous, that's okay. That's normal. Yeah. Take a leap. But if suddenly it's my small self that's scared, nervous, and all that, that's, oh, that's a trigger, run.
Not necessarily. Okay. So possibly run. So this is the second caveat to that. So if it's adult you, continue in it. If it's little you, we want to investigate. So that's the question to ask. Okay? So adult me, stay in. If it's little me, that's room for investigation. So what we want to investigate is this mirroring my childhood, or is the young part perceiving danger where there might not be danger?
Right.
Remember the past?
Yes.
So what we want to do in this, the way that we figure this out is, if a young part is present, we must go slow. And I know that might be hard for people listening to hear, because we live in like a time where people are having sex on third dates or second dates or whatever, and they're moving like really fast in relationship. If you do that and you have young parts present, that's a recipe for high dysregulation and actually showing your young parts they can't trust you and that you aren't safe in relationships for them. So the way that we tease this apart is, number one, going slower than we might want to go, meaning I need to get to know you. This is an interview process. Mm-hmm. This isn't just, you don't get to be exposed to all my younger self and all of me. And secondly, we need, for those young parts, they need us to use our voice. That means by setting boundaries, but I'm not just talking sexual boundaries, by setting any boundaries at all, and also by communicating our truth. And when we start to do that, by communicating our truth and setting boundaries, our nervous system doesn't have to protect us. See, if we don't use our voice and set boundaries, our nervous system will automatically come in and protect us and protect those young parts. So if I set the boundaries, use my voice, my nervous system doesn't need to come in. my younger parts start to see that they can trust me and I'm safe. And then I gather data from that other person. Because if they, when I communicate my truth, they see me, they're curious about it, they can hold that, they want to know more about it, they respect my boundaries. This all gathers data and shows me, oh, the young part is just perceiving threat. It's not actual danger.
Got it. What do I do if, for example, when I'm trying to, my adult self, to set those boundaries to create a safe environment, and the other person maybe doesn't cross those boundaries, but brings in their emotions and how they feel and all that, and automatically, suddenly, it will then make me feel bad for even setting those boundaries. How do I work on that or still put my foot down? Because automatically, I just want to fix the situation and I completely forget my own needs. They don't matter as much as long as I can just make the other person feel fine.
Mm-hmm. Well, more often than not, when we set our boundaries, and by the way, boundaries are informed by our internal truth and our limits. So that's what tells us what the boundary is. What is my internal truth and what is my limit that most of us, especially in dating, bypass?
Right.
Oh, it's okay. It's not that big of a deal. It's okay. And when we do that, we are literally not protecting ourselves and those parts of ourselves, which means we're not showing up authentically in the relationship. We're not creating a container that can actually be safe and healing for us. It's not safe once we do that. So more often than not, when we set a boundary, there's going to be parts of us that are terrified about it. Because for many of us, it wasn't safe to set a boundary in the past, especially in childhood. So just know, setting boundaries is not going to be like a day where it feels really good. Probably going to be scary. And what we want to look at is, in dating, for example, if I'm dating, which I am, is how do you respond to my boundary? Now, if you respond, you know, they might not like it if I say I need to move slower sexually, or I just, seeing you 3 times a week feels a little too much for me right now, or whatever. And if they respond with saying, like, that's okay, no big deal, we have plenty of time to get to know each other,
right,
that is a super green flag. What that means is they have enough self-regulation in their own nervous system that mm-hmm. their young part isn't showing up. Their adult self can hear me, and they just created safety. And when I work with people that I'm like, going slower is the way this is gonna be better, I'm like, I don't wanna go slow. I'd say the irony is you're actually going to be able to move faster if you go slower. Because if somebody says, sure, that's no problem, I can wait a month, 2 months, however long you want to wait, doesn't matter, I like you, I like spending time with you, all of a sudden, I feel really safe.
Right.
If they respond by doing something like this, I say, like, I really need to move slow, and they go, oh, okay.
They make you feel guilty,
yes,
or they pull away.
There's something wrong with you.
Yeah.
Why do you need to move slow? If they pull away.
No one has ever said that to me before. That's really weird that you feel that way. I've never had that problem before.
Yeah, exactly.
Like that.
Shaming, things like that. That is a sign for you that's not a safe person. And that's somebody that I would recommend. That person needs to do a lot of their own work. Because what they're doing in that moment is they're not in their adult self. They're trying to do everything that they can to make you not set the boundary. They're probably recapitulating their own childhood, just as it's making us experience our own childhood. And now what I feel from that person is I'm not safe. And what did I need to do when I was a kid? Acquiesce and be what you need me to be, and then I'll be safe. And so now I'm in this relationship and I'm dating and I'm doing these things I don't really want to do because I feel like that's what I need to do to be safe. And then I feel shame about it later.
Right, because the people who are most upset about your boundaries are the people that need to cross them the most.
Exactly. And people, and the irony is, here's the thing, the people that we need to set boundaries with the most are often people, they're going to be the people that are going to be most resistant to our boundaries.
Right.
You need to set less boundaries with really safe people because their response is going to be like, of course, it's fine.
What's the best way to respond to someone who, let's say, you say, oh, can you not do this, blah, blah, and then their response is, well, no one has ever said that to me. You're like literally the first person that's ever bothered them. Or, you know, you kind of remind me of my mother or my father who I dislike. Because they're the only person that's ever bothered them. So then you think, oh shit, there must be something wrong with me. So how do you then respond in a way that you can, you know, have them understand you versus just be like, okay, that's danger, they're the wrong person for me, never speak to them again?
Yeah. So, well, I want, though, people, if you're just starting to date and that happens, I would like, as someone who feels protective of every single person listening to this podcast, I would like you to take that as a pretty big sign of this person has done no work and they're not safe for you yet. And instead of saying like, but this is a second date, I should keep dating them, they're giving you a lot of evidence of how unsafe they are for you. Now, what if you want to still try, what I would recommend is in that moment, you are likely going to be triggered in a young part. And I don't recommend our young parts having to advocate for us because they never should have had to do that. So in that moment, I would be triggered in, like, that's very human. You'd be triggered in a young part because they just shamed you. In that moment, if you feel like you're triggered in a young part, it's important to stop the interaction and say, you know what? I think if you're on the phone, like, let's talk later. And once I get adult me back, or if we're hanging out, let's not talk about this right now. Mm. And once I get adult me back, if I really want to see, could this be possible? Then what I want to say is, I start with anytime we're talking about conflict, we want to start with a positive because it shows the person's nervous system that we're safe. I really like you. And I think you're really wonderful. And when I set that boundary last week, it was really scary for me to do. I just want you to know that. That was really hard for me to do because it feels scary. Because it's new for me. And your response didn't feel honoring of my boundary, and it made me feel shame for having this boundary, and this is just my truth, and that I should feel ashamed of my truth, and it made me feel really unsafe. And I really need to share that with you. Now, if they were just having a very weird day, then they would respond and say, I'm so sorry that I did that. You're totally right. That wasn't okay, and that's something that I really need to work on. Okay, continue with the relationship. If they say to you another shaming thing, or they say, I didn't do that, I don't know what you're talking about.
Right.
Then they're giving you more data about how unsafe they are. And it's really important that we don't disregard our younger parts and self-sacrifice in a relationship unless we want to keep having the same pattern over and over again.
Right. I like that. I actually was asking more the question for me, the example had to do with a friendship boundary.
Oh, yeah.
But I like that you're saying that actually felt validating to me to be like, oh, I guess I should have paid attention that instead of just always assuming everything's my fault, that, yeah, maybe it was an unsafe person. Because the communication was, this was a while back with some other friend where every time we would have conversations, I never had a chance to say my thoughts because the person would speak over me and then go speaking about themselves. And one time I said, hey, listen, I love that you love to share your experiences, but it makes me feel like what I have to say doesn't matter because you're just waiting to share what you have to say, or it feels like I have to speak through my story to you because you're just already ready to speak. And I would appreciate, like then it makes me feel like there's no point. It's already so hard for me to share. And then what my friend said was, well, no one has ever had that problem. Like all my friends, we just talk over each other. And we just love sharing, blah, blah. Like the only person this reminds me, like my mother is the only person that's ever complained, me knowing my friend has issues with her mother. So I was like, oh, okay. And that, of course, that made me feel shut down. So I appreciate the validation because I thought, okay, I approached this in a very calm, peaceful manner. And I tried to state that it's important for me.
You did everything right in that.
Oh, okay.
Beautifully. That's a beautiful example of doing it exactly right and how we can expect. And that's what I want people to anticipate. When I set a boundary, unless the person has done a lot of work, there's a good chance that's going to happen because they don't want us to set the boundary and they don't want to have to look at themselves. And so what we want to do after, it's really important that we connect to what our truth was. Like, I know this is my truth. Doesn't matter how much they tried. That's gaslighting what they were doing. How much they tried to take away my truth. This was the truth.
Right. And because I wasn't living in my truth with myself, and I was constantly crossing my own boundaries in my own life. That's why I wasn't able to live in the truth with even a platonic friendship, because the minute that happened, my brain thought, oh, okay, then I'll just lower my expectations, which is what I did. So nothing ever got resolved. And now I lower my expectations. I'm not living my truth in my friendships. I'm getting constantly irritated. I feel just getting shut down more and more because of course, if I can't even trust myself to keep my word with myself where I'm going to set boundaries with friends and then I don't, how am I going to live my truth with actual people outside in the world, right?
Exactly. That's exactly right.
And which I'm not friends with that person now this year after I finally, nothing even happened. It was one day I woke up and I started thinking about it and I said, why did I ever put up with all of that? I don't understand. And it made me angry at myself. And then I decided to take a step back and I've been happy with that decision.
Yeah, because what you decided was you said, I'm not going to sacrifice myself anymore. I'm going to choose me. And until we choose us, we can't actually then draw in people who are also going to be choosing us properly and fully.
Right.
Because they first choose themselves. That's the root of a healthy relationship, that I choose me first and then I choose you. And if we're both doing that and we're both in the relationship saying, I want to be better. Like, you know, because we can't get it all right. And there's something that a friend is going to say that doesn't feel good. But they can take accountability and ownership and keep working on it. And I can do the same. That's what makes lasting, healthy relationships, whether they're platonic or romantic or work.
Right. I love all that. And I love that. I think as long as, A, you're living in your truth and you are honest with yourself, that you can be honest with others. You are constantly then working towards regulating your nervous system, working on your past trauma. And then, of course, with the relationships you have in your life, platonic or romantic, it's all about coming to an understanding where both people understand each other and they're doing the work together in order to grow together versus grow apart. Lastly, we're going to have to wrap up this interview, although it was amazing. And thank you so much for everything you shared. Do you have any final words that you wanted to share with my listeners?
Yeah, I just want everybody to know a couple things. The first is that they make sense, that we all make sense, that there's nothing actually wrong with us. If we're experiencing dysregulation or we're stuck in our lives, it's just a clue that our nervous system doesn't know we're safe. And that's not a broken system or a weak system. It's actually a really, really strong system that's been working so hard to protect us and save our lives. And if it can do that for sometimes decades, it can come into rest, which means coming into regulation. And when we do that, and that is our birthright healing, life opens up to us. And that's what's meant for every single one of us.
I love that. Where can people find you?
You can find me on Instagram. I do a lot of free teaching and free sharing on there at Sarah with an HB Coaching. Or you can find me at sarahbaldwincoaching.com.
Great. And do you have anything that you're currently working on or promoting that you want to share?
Yeah, I have a 3-day experience called Expansion Experience coming within a month. And that's to support people to understand the system keeping us stuck and then to help us to step into the big life that we're desiring. And then right after that, an 8-week program that's going to help us do exactly that called You Make Sense.
Okay, I love that. Anyway, you guys, thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for coming on my podcast. Make sure to follow her and check out all of her work and DM her if you have any questions. Thank you so much for listening. And don't forget to pay attention to your nervous system and to work on regulating it. Right?
Thank you. Exactly right.
Okay.
Thank you.
Bye, guys.